Hi everyone, welcome to EHS This Week's podcast for the week ending July the 18th. I'm Nicola DeCuna.
And I'm Allison Granke.
And we're bringing you the latest stories in environmental health and safety. So Allison, I think you're going to start off with a story about the CDC.
Yeah, so the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, also known as the CDC, has released a report that reviews the anthrax incident that occurred last month. So early in June, personnel were unintentionally exposed to potentially viable anthrax at the CDC's Roy Ball campus. This was a very serious biosafety incident, as most forms of the disease are lethal, and it affects both humans and animals. So on June 5th of this year, a laboratory scientist was working with anthrax when they made a mistake. They used a process that they thought would kill the anthrax bacteria, and it may not have. Because of that, workers in other laboratories who received materials from that laboratory may have been exposed to anthrax. Luckily, none of the staff members that were potentially exposed have become ill, and the report concludes that while not impossible, it is extremely unlikely that there was in fact exposure to viable anthrax. But according to CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden, there is definite concern about the policies and procedures that allowed this event to occur in the first place. However, while finalizing this report, the CDC also was made aware of another incident that occurred earlier in the year. A culture of non-pathogenic avian influenza was unintentionally cross-contaminated at the CDC influenza laboratory with the highly pathogenic H5N1 strain of influenza, and then shipped to an agent laboratory operated by the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture. Following these two incidents, there have been some allegations that there is a problem with the safety culture at the CDC. The CDC director has said that these incidents reveal totally unacceptable behavior and should never have happened.
What is the CDC doing to find and address the root cause of the incidents?
Well, so far, in response, a moratorium has been issued on CDC transferring any biological materials, such as infectious agents, active or inactive specimens, out of BSL-3 or BSL-4 laboratories. BSL stands for biosafety level, and biosafety level 3 and 4 labs handle the more dangerous, exotic, and potentially lethal agents. So the moratorium is remaining in place pending a review by an advisory committee. And this advisory committee will be a high-level working group reporting to the CDC director that will accelerate improvements in laboratory safety and review and improve on a lab-by-lab basis the resumed transfer of biological materials outside of these BSL 3 and 4 labs. The CDC has also begun the process of establishing an external advisory group for lab safety, and they've initiated an investigation to determine the root causes that led to the aviation influenza virus to be contaminated by the H5N1 virus. That influenza laboratory is now closed and will not reopen until adequate procedures are put in place. There are several other measures that are underway as well, and for more information on that, you can take a look at the CDC's recent press release in the resources section of this podcast. So these are two pretty scary near misses from the sounds of it. In both cases, the implications could have been much, much worse if exposure had occurred. The good news is that it does appear that the CDC is acting swiftly and appropriately to ensure that another event such as these ones doesn't occur. And if any of our listeners want to read the full report on the anthrax incident, you can find the link in the resources section of this podcast. And I guess we'll all stay tuned to hear more about the influenza incident as that investigation takes place.
So we'll definitely keep an eye out for that. So switching topics, I have a story on heat stress. So every summer, thousands of workers, usually in agriculture, landscaping, construction, utilities, and support activities for oil and gas operations, they spend long days working in the hot sun. But excessive heat and sun can lead to many dangers, such as sunburn, dehydration, heat cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke, which means every year many become ill or lose their lives because of the sun exposure. The International Safety Equipment Association, ISEA, is urging outdoor workers to stay hydrated and drink plenty of fluids, such as water or electrolyte-replacing beverages. Drinking water helps prevent dehydration, which is a primary cause of both heat cramps and heat exhaustion. So taking breaks and cool-down periods, as well as wearing heat stress protection safety equipment, will help reduce heat-related illnesses. When high heat environments are unavoidable, there are certain types of personal protective equipment, or PPE, that can be used as preventive measures. ISEA encourages employers to stay current on cooling products and prevention of heat stress to enable employees to protect themselves in these situations.
So what are some suggestions for how outdoor workers can protect themselves?
Good question. So to minimize contact with excess heat, ISEA recommends these interventions for outdoor workers. use cooling vests and other cooling clothing or accessories to keep your overall body temperature at a moderate level. Wear broad-brimmed hats and lightweight clothing to reduce direct sun exposure. Wear lightweight, fast-drying clothes. Sweat causes the body to work even harder to stay cool, as it is an insulating layer to the skin. And I've also included some links in our resources section on heat safety that will be helpful to employers and employees. One is OSHA's heat safety tool, which is a smartphone app, and the other one you can download ISEA's list of heat stress solutions.
Sounds good. I have an update from the EPA this week. So this week, the Environmental Protection Agency has released a proposal to prohibit the use of certain chemicals that are contributing significantly to climate change now that safer and more climate-friendly alternatives exist. So this is the agency's second action that aims to reduce emissions of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, a class of particularly nasty greenhouse gases. This proposal is estimated to reduce greenhouse gases by up to 42 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent by 2020, which is equal to the carbon dioxide emissions from the annual electricity use of more than 5 million homes. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said this week that this action will not only result in significant reductions of harmful greenhouse gases, but it will also encourage businesses to continue bringing safer alternatives to the market. This proposal is part of a program called SNAP, which stands for the Significant New Alternatives Policy that operates under the authority of the Clean Air Act. The HFCs and HFC-containing blends that are affected by this latest proposal are used in aerosols, motor vehicle air conditioning, retail food refrigeration and vending machines, and foam blowing. This latest proposal is the result of input from industry, environmental groups, and others that the EPA gathered over the past year, and the EPA will be accepting comments on the proposal for 60 days following its publication in the Federal Register. So if you're interested in learning more about the proposal and the EPA's SNAP program, you can find a link in the resources section of this podcast. Nicola, I think you also had an environmental story to share with us.
Yes, so more and more businesses are recognizing employee engagement as an essential strategy for achieving their goals. And engaging employees can include a variety of initiatives such as volunteer programs, competitions, cash incentives, games and giveaways, as well as award and recognition programs. But what is employee engagement exactly? Well, it's not just employee happiness or satisfaction, but it's also the emotional commitment that the employee has to the organization and its goals. Engaged employees are those that care about their organization, that work on behalf of the organization's goals, rather than just for a paycheck or a promotion. So despite an increasing focus on employee engagement, research suggests businesses are not capturing the full potential of their companies. A 2013 Gallup report found that only 25-30% of the U.S. working population is engaged in their work.
So how can we make employee engagement a central business strategy that creates value?
Well, companies' employee engagement campaigns are a major effort to change employee behavior, so they aspire to get employees to do something new. So the building, which is the physical place, serves as the main area of employee engagement. This is not only because it helps answer the basic question, is the building or work environment a place that I want to be, but it also influences how the choice aligns with the desired outcome. So for example, if you're an ad agency that cherishes highly creative employees that in turn value inspiring creative environments, does your building reinforce that engagement? So companies of all shapes and sizes must consider the extent to which their buildings reinforce the goals and the workplace environment that they seek, especially when those goals and the environments are changing. One important aspect to remember is that some of the most basic ways that employers can improve employee engagement include making buildings healthier and more comfortable for employees with improved thermal conditions, improving air quality, ventilation, and lighting. So major companies like Google are also focusing deeply on comfort and health in their buildings. So improving physical comfort is a really big part of a green building. Projects that achieve energy savings, such as reducing a building's energy consumption by 50%, is a meaningful part of an employee engagement strategy. A 2012 study actually demonstrated that the greater use of natural light improves comfort among the users of the space. There are several findings from a study from 2007 about the sensitivity of employee work performance based on changes in the physical office environment, with an emphasis on the comfort associated with temperature. So even changes in comfort across a single floor of an office building can lead to variations in work performance. So it sounds obvious, but if you feel too hot or too cold at work, your performance and engagement will suffer. And then finally, engagement drives company profits. So when employees are more engaged, they're more productive. So an employee that does not have a headache from an office's outdated lighting system is going to have the mental capacity to come with the next great innovation for the company. Employees that are not distracted by how cold or how warm they feel will want to take the time they need to collaborate and develop a solution to the issue holding back the company's latest product or service. So essentially, this means organizations are more likely to retain employees that are engaged in their work. And engaged employees also further the goals of an organization. Research findings from 29 studies indicated a correlation between employee engagement and service, sales, quality, safety, retention, and profits. It's no surprise that engaged employees provide better service and quality and productivity, which improves customer satisfaction. And high customer satisfaction then leads to increased sales, which can lead to repeat sales and referrals, which then leads to higher levels of profits and higher shareholder returns. So more business leaders are convinced that better buildings lead to better employees and better company performance. Transformed, healthier buildings can help businesses unlock full potential of employee engagement in their organizations.
That sounds like a good thing.
I'm sure we'll see more on this topic as organizations work to make their businesses healthier and then how it affects their employee engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have an update from OSHA to finish us off this week. In response to some recent fatalities related to construction demolitions, OSHA has launched an updated website with resources for this industry. On June 20th, a construction worker taking down an old Blockbuster video building in New Jersey was trapped and killed when the last standing wall of a building under demolition collapsed on top of him. 6 months before that, a construction worker in Chicago was struck and killed by falling concrete while conducting renovations on a shopping mall. And in June of 2013, six people were killed and 14 injured in Philadelphia when a four-story building undergoing demolition collapsed. So these are all really tragic and preventable incidents that OSHA wants to draw attention to as a reminder to protect workers from demolition hazards. In recent years, the most common OSHA citation for the construction demolition standards was a failure to conduct an engineering survey to determine the condition of the structure prior to demolition. So this includes determining whether an unplanned collapse of the building or any nearby structure could injure those who are working in the area. To check out these demolition safety resources yourself, which include guidance documents and training courses, you can find a link to OSHA's newly updated website for the construction demolition industry in the resources section of this podcast.
And I think that's it for the week. I hope you enjoyed this week's stories, and we'll talk to you next week.
Have a safe week, everyone.